Hello, everyone, and welcome back to an all-new episode of The Financial Confessions. It's me, your girl, Chelsea Fagan, founder and CEO of The Financial Diet and woman who loves to talk about money. And today I am here with a guest that I've really been looking forward to having back on the show. She was notably here for an episode that I've listened to twice but never watched because it's the worst haircut I've ever had in my life on the episode that we did together. I look like Melon Cat. I had that haircut for literally a week and my husband was like, this has to go. I don't know if I can feel the same way about you as I usually do with that haircut. So suffice to say, I encourage you to go back and listen to our first interview, but black out your screen so you can't see me. This episode is sponsored by Quince. Shop high quality luxury items without luxury prices. Go to quince.com/TFC to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/TFC. And thanks to Delete Me for supporting TFC. Remove your personal info from data broker websites. And we have a special discount for you. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/TFC and use promo code TFC. But in all seriousness, I wanted to have this guest back because not only is she, I would say, one of the reigning queens of personal finance, she is also just such a cool woman all around, someone I love talking to about topics that go way beyond money. We're cooking up some cool stuff on that front that you'll hear more about later. And also it's just like, she's a snappy dresser. She's a chic mom. She brings a lot to the table. And notably, she brings this brand new book that just came out October 3rd, A Healthy State of Panic, which, among other things, features me talking about my choice not to have children. But it's all about fears and using them to propel us into the life that we deserve to have. So enough of my rambling. Let's get to our guest, Farnoosh Torabi.
Hi, Chelsea. First of all, Did you call me chic?
Please.
Coming from the... from the chicest woman on this side of the planet, really.
Please, that's
and I remember kind. That bad hair day, not because I remember it as a bad hair day, but because you were distraught.
I was, okay.
You were distraught.
Listen, I think that any time a woman gets like very blunt bang, she's going through some sort of mental crisis.
Yeah.
And I like watch, oh no, I'm sorry, our producer behind the camera has blunt bangs. Were you in a crisis when you cut them? Yeah. See? Okay. The theory stands.
Now I always think of Fleabag, that where the sister gets the pencil. I look like a pencil.
Yes.
She did, but she kind of asked for it.
She did ask for it. But suffice to say, thank you. And thank you for being here. So obviously I teed up the book a tiny bit, but tell us about it.
Thank you. This is my fourth book after 9 years of not writing a book. I think I had PTSD after that, you know.
Really?
Writing books is hard, as you know, and I think also in the last 9 years I've been podcasting and I've been doing different things, and I didn't really have anything else to say about money, which is probably why this book isn't really about money. It's a book about my childhood growing up as the daughter of Iranian immigrants and fear being very present in our household. My parents say they intentionally raised me to be afraid because that's how they felt they could keep me on the straight and narrow, out of danger, protected. And I don't recommend this as a parenting style, but I can now in my 40s appreciate that foundation. I had to have a very early on understanding of fear and how to work with it as opposed to combating it. And so when I wrote this book, I wanted it to be part memoir, part guidebook, offering readers a way to think about fear differently, as for me, it's been a tool.
Tell me a little bit more in practicality what allowing fears to guide you looks like. Like, what does that mean?
It means that when you, and I focused on 9 different fears in the book. So this isn't a book about how all fear all the time can be useful. Like, we all have phobias. This book isn't about phobias. It's about when you have that really sort of nagging adrenaline, tapping on the shoulder, inner fear at life's crossroads where the stakes are high, dealing with things pertaining to money, family, your career, your health, your livelihood, that when you are scared in those moments, it can be an opportunity to ask the fear questions. And by asking the fear questions, I mean really asking yourself questions, right? So why am I scared? Where is this fear coming from? I'm a journalist, so I like to ask a lot of questions. And I bring that to this practice of working with fear, asking it questions like, where did you come from? Are you real? Or are you something that I inherited and I attached onto myself because of the external world telling me that I should be afraid of this thing? What do you want me to protect? What do you want me to look out for? Should I take a pause? I mean, look, if you are afraid before you do something big with your money, maybe you should stop and think about what you're about to do. That fear is a protective signal in our bodies. It's an abundant resource in our bodies, especially right now. In the primitive era, fear was really there to help us protect ourselves from death and protect our lives. And I think as we've evolved, fear has evolved. And fear not only shows up when it's a life or death moment, but potentially when our livelihoods are at stake. The things that we really care about, the things that we want to execute and create in our lives because that's how we define success or fulfillment. And that's how you do it. You have to ask fear questions. With that information, you use it to go make the decisions that you want to make. I present as fearless a lot in my world, and so do we all, but that doesn't mean that I'm not having a relationship with fear. It doesn't mean that I didn't have, you know, a conversation with fear first. Chances are if you see me on stage talking to 500 people, that can be scary, but it's because ahead of that, I knew what was at stake and I prepared for it. The fear was like, you might screw up. So I went ahead and I prepared and I made sure that I did a tech run and all the things. And that's a very simple example. But in real life, in real sort of more layered situations, like with relationships or money, it never hurts to listen to your fears and kind of take a step back and go, how can I do that thing over there that kind of seems scary, whether that's investing or buying that house or getting married or leaving the job, while protecting what's important to me, feeling like I will be successful because I've done X, Y, and Z. What's the work that I need to do? And fear is just a great way to kind of stop and recognize that about yourself, that you want to protect yourself from something.
You talk a lot in the book about your experience as, you know, growing up as the daughter of Iranian immigrants and, you know, a lot of sort of the messages you received and the things that you internalized. And we have had a fair amount of people on the show who come from a similar background and talk about kind of the mixed blessing of that and the both the good and bad that came from it in terms of the way they navigate the world. I had dinner last night with a friend of mine who is the daughter of an immigrant who she was recently helping her mother with some work stuff. Her mother's a cashier at CVS. She's 62. And she found out in helping her mother navigate the portal for healthcare stuff that her mom makes $30,000 a year at 62. And she was saying how what upsets her about that she knows that that's how her mother values and sees herself. Mm. And she was saying, you know, growing up, there was such a heavy premium put on the education I get, the job I get, the ways in which I succeed, and that there was never sort of a freedom to see or pursue yourself beyond those very kind of specific paradigms, which again is something that we hear from a lot of first gen people who come on the show. Can you talk a little bit about your experience with that?
Mm-hmm. I write about my mom a lot in this book. And as I think a lot of mother-daughter relationships, it's complex, it's highly layered. And like, if I was to write this book 20 years ago, it would be a different take on my mom. But now in my 40s, I'm a mom now. I have a lot more compassion for everything that she did for me, and I didn't always maybe see it that way. I always thought maybe she was like not doing her best, but now in retrospect, my mom was, I think, like a lot of immigrant women to this country, they come here young, they're probably already moms, or my mom was 19 when she had me. She didn't have a college degree. She had just graduated from high school. She didn't speak the language. She didn't have a license. She didn't have money. My dad was basically her economic blanket. And I was there, and she was terrified. She was a terrified woman, as I probably would have been also.
Right.
And the thing about my mom is that she had so many, I mean, the reason they were in America was because they wanted their children and themselves to have better lives. But I think that the emphasis on the children was greater than on themselves. And no one ever said to my mom, what are your hopes and dreams?
Yeah.
And then the follow-up to that, which is, great, let me help you. we've all had those moments probably in our lives as Americans born in America, and she never had that. And so I think her growth was stunted. And I recognize this now, and I feel bad about it now. You know, maybe when I was growing up, I would see other American moms working and maybe even being breadwinners, and she wasn't. And I was like, why doesn't she want that for herself? But I think it's because she didn't have the support system that some others of us do. And I think that's not a small thing. And even within her community and culture, that wasn't modeled. So I think she just thought she was doing the best she could. As long as her kids were doing well, that for her was the badge of honor. And so I always think, as the daughter of immigrants, if I'm ever at a moment where I'm feeling defeated or like tired or, you know, wanting to give up, I wonder, what is my excuse? What is my excuse? My parents came here with far less. They built a life for themselves and their children.
Escaping a revolution.
They escaped a revolution. And so I owe it to this legacy that they've created and now I'm living out to sort of see it through and also pass down these values to my children. So I don't know if that answers your question, but it's very complex. And I think it is sad in some ways, but also really endearing in others. And our parents did the best they could. They really did with what they had, the little network they had, the little resource, the few resources they had. And it's true. I mean, for growing up, it was never like, I hope you become a financial author or an entrepreneur. It was like, you should really go to law school. Or, you know, when I got into journalism school, it was received with a bit of skepticism, you know, like, even though I was like, Mom, it's Columbia. Oh, okay. If it's Columbia, it's fine. You know, they were worried because, again, I think it's just, you're afraid of what you don't know. They didn't know that there might be another way to have their children achieve financial success beyond what they had experienced, beyond what they had seen modeled. And so, again, got to have a lot of compassion. I often hear from children of immigrants who are now adults, and maybe they had pursued the straight and narrow, or like what their parents wanted them to do, which was they became doctors or lawyers, or they worked at Google. That's a fast way to an immigrant mom's heart, is tell her you work at Facebook or Google. And now they want to open a salon, or they want to pursue the arts, or they want to take a break and then figure things out. And they're terrified because of how this might be reflected back onto their parents and what that conversation is going to be like. And immigrant parents, and I'm generalizing here, but I think, you know, they're a tough crowd.
Well, you mentioned something you said earlier kind of stuck out to me, which is that you think about, what is my excuse, when you look at what your parents did, which from the outside, you seem like the type of person, which I do recognize somewhat in myself, who puts an exorbitant level of pressure on yourself to succeed, and to succeed by very specific standards, and to have a real sort of, I guess, a level of manifesting things that aligns with your vision for your life that I think 90% of people would not go for. Like, they would not even try, I think, you know, the aims that you have for yourself. And I wonder sometimes, because my parents aren't immigrants, but I was low income growing up, which I think does often manifest in similar things of, what's your excuse? And you have these, you know, really kind of, also is a sense of scarcity, a sense of pressure, a sense of needing to succeed at a certain level to achieve true sustainability. But to what extent do you feel like that feeling of, like, what's my excuse? I always must be striving for excellence is sort of robbing yourself of the ability to just live, you know, the life that so many people in this country were privileged to. They were privileged to never ask themselves those questions or put that level of pressure on themselves.
It's such an important question. And I think that in my more recent years, I've had to catch myself to say, like, it's okay to have fun. It's okay to do something because it's just easier. That my dad, especially, I think for him, and I think I grew up probably, I inherited this to some extent, that unless it's hard and unless it's a struggle, there's no valor in it. There's no honor in it. And even to this day, like, if you ask my father, how's work going? And he goes right to sort of what's not working about work, so that he can kind of talk about the struggle. But he's obsessed with it. He loves that. He loves, like, problem solving in his profession, but also in life. And I think he just is of that generation and era of, again, the immigrant mentality. Like, you come here with nothing, and there's like a lot of pride in being able to build something out of nothing and all the work and struggle that goes into it. And so for me, it's like someone asked me the other day, what fiction books are you reading? And I was like, I have a really hard time escaping into fiction, because I feel my sort of the daughter of my dad's brain is like, that's too fun. You need to be learning all the time. Yes, you need to be getting an ROI. It's my dad's favorite acronym on everything. And so letting loose has been something that I have to be more conscious of, and like just being like, it's okay to just relax. It's okay to, and I do now, trust me, like I've gotten a lot better at this. Like, I take naps during the day. I
love a nap.
I have, you know, silly shows that I watch. I am reading fiction. I think that it's also fine for me to want to do something that is just easier, even though maybe it doesn't make intellectual sense, but it makes a lot of emotional sense for me. And I write about those things in the book. There was a episode in my life, twice actually, for each child, that I chose not to breastfeed.
Oh, yes, yes.
And my first child was born 9 years ago, and
I'm so sorry for a second. I was like, you're about to say I chose not to have children. I was like, wait, what?
We can talk about that. So I'm telling the story about, you know, my choice to not breastfeed, and it's not because I have cancer. It's not because I didn't have breast milk. It's not because of any thing that was wrong with me necessarily. I wasn't, you know, incapable of doing this. Right. I just chose not to, because it was a lot easier for our family to formula feed.
I was not breastfed.
And
I'm a genius. Yeah, so let's get that straight.
Okay, I used to use myself and my husband as the example. I'm just going to use you as the example. Like, and also, since you were born, the engineering of formula has gotten a 100%. Lot better. So nevertheless, when I made this choice, I was so terrified to tell anybody outside of my home and my doctor's office that I was doing this, because of the judgment and the backlash, because I just felt like I am choosing something that's easier, and I don't think that's going to be respected. And also because there's a lot of opinion out there about formula versus breast milk, and, you know, breast milk being best. And even in the city where my kids were born, New York City, Mayor Bloomberg at the time had just thrown this huge campaign against formula. And he had told the nurses and the doctors at the pediatric wards to lock up the formula. And so you have that as well happening. And so I felt very scared to talk about it, but I am okay to talk about it now, because I think 10 years later, we're okay to talk about it.
But also, like, I mean, just on such a core level, who gives a shit? Like, the amount of microplastics I consume today, like, it just, I think there is such, especially in certain spaces with mothers. Now, I am child-free. It's mentioned in the book. We'll discuss it. But I used to be a nanny for very affluent families for a long time. And in those spaces, the more, you know, affluent communities and mothers within them, the hyperfixation on a total optimization of your child's development, rearing, all of that kind of stuff. Like, first of all, as someone who grew up low income, like, we were just handed some sticks and put outside to go entertain ourselves all day. And honestly, we were probably better for it. But also, and, you know, 90s kids were raised on nothing but Kool-Aid and Cheetos and bologna, like, cereal, white bread, whatever. But also, like, every president we've ever had, I'm sure their mother smoked and drank while they were pregnant. Like,
do we really want to get into it?
Do we?
Yeah.
Like, and I do think that there is this, and I imagine, because for the first few years of deciding I didn't want children and dealing with some people in my life being not so cool about it, I similarly struggled with a feeling of like needing to defend and justify myself. But I do think that that feeling of unplugging from the matrix of like really understanding how few things are A, really worth getting worked up about, but B, how few people's opinions matter is like, until you get over that.
Well, I was reminded of this story too, because when I was when I was still pregnant and kind of looking, researching, you know, breast milk formula, et cetera, I would inevitably meet moms who had breastfed who were like, it was the hardest thing I ever did. And they would almost say it like...
Hard in what sense?
Like, well, it's exhausting, oh, you know, okay. And it's time consuming to breastfeed on demand, right? For your child, that's like, you're essentially a vessel, a food vessel for your kid in the first year. And so that means that everything gets delayed. Your ability to, you know, eat what you want, get back to your routines. I heard this from a lot of moms that it was in some ways the most rigorous thing they had to do physically and mentally. And it's hard. I mean, it hurts in the beginning.
So I've heard.
And so I tried. And I would always like question, like, why are they so miserable doing this? And yet they're still doing this. And don't we want, I felt like, again, as a mom, unless the struggle is real, you're not really momming right. You know, like the more you struggle, the more you're a better parent, I guess. I don't know. Like that's the message that I was getting. And so when I chose to breastfeed, there was shame attached to that for me that I didn't want people to know because then they would judge me as far as like how good of a mom I was, which I know is BS. Like my intelligent brain was like, that's BS. But I lived in Brooklyn. It was
no, Park Slope.
Okay. Close to Park Slope. Yeah.
So. Yeah. Those moms. I mean,
it was a
stressful.
Yeah.
I feel judged by them and I don't even have a kid walking by.
I mean, I was getting judged in the hospital when I asked for formula. So by baby number two, I just brought my own. Yep.
Do okay. That. Okay. But also, and I'm sure like the little Astrid and Kenzie and all of the, yeah. But listen, I think it's totally right. And I would probably have, like I said, a similar thing, but I do think one of the bigger, like it really bothers me that there's not that macro analysis of choices like this, which obviously you do talk about in this book and your work as kind of looking at it from a more broad financial and kind of sociocultural level, which is like not to bring it into the Eve Rodsky of it all, but like part of the issue with breastfeeding for women today is like in an ideal environment where we have super comprehensive maternity leave,
right,
and women are able to take a year to focus on being a mother, as they do in many civilized countries, and husbands were equal partners,
right,
in hetero marriages. The concept of breastfeeding would be completely different because right now in many dynamics, when we already have these dynamics, no guaranteed maternity leave, women taking on the majority of child rearing, even when they work full-time jobs, creating a situation or being in a situation where you are physically tied to that child in a way that your male partner is not, like, I hope that for every marriage that the man is making Herculean efforts to overcome that. But 9 times out of 10, they are not.
Right. And that's really, for us, why it was easiest. It wasn't just because mom wants to get back to her workout routine and eat, like, you know, whatever she wants to eat. It's because I ran a business and I wanted to get back to the business because I was the breadwinner as soon as I could, physically and mentally. And when you're breastfeeding constantly, there's a lot of interruption. Let alone working for a company, how hard is that? I mean, it was hard enough working from home, trying to breastfeed and finding the time and trying to tend to the business. When we used formula, it made it so that my husband and I could feed our baby equally.
Yeah.
And we could one night he was on duty and the other night I was on duty, and it wasn't all on my
shoulders.
On my shoulders to be this food vessel for my kid.
Well, listen, like I said in the beginning, I was not breastfed, and I'm not even going to say I'm fine.
Unfollow me.
I'm great. So as many of you might know, shopping for high-quality, evergreen wardrobe items is really important to me, but spending the insane amount of money that they often cost is not something I'm trying to do when building out my wardrobe. I discovered Quince earlier this year and have genuinely recommended it to so many people. I have bought so many Quince items with my own money. Fun fact, I'm not wearing a Quince top today, but only literally because all of the ones I have are either dirty and in the laundry because I wear them so frequently, or they're packed because I'm leaving tomorrow for a short trip and they're like in my A-list clothes that always get packed. But suffice to say, I have become a Quince girly this year. And if you want to take a look at me in one of my favorite Quince blouses, here I am in all my glory. But as we talk about many times here at TFD, we are all about cost per use. You are much better off investing a little bit upfront in something that can be worn again and again than in paying bottom barrel prices for something that you will end up having to replace almost immediately. And with Quince, you get those investment level pieces without having to pay exorbitant investment level prices. All of Quince's prices are 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They partner directly with top factories to cut out the cost of the middleman and pass the savings on to you. Quince creates timeless classics that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. This includes all of the capsule wardrobe must-haves like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters from $50 or washable silk tops and dresses, my personal favorites. But as I mentioned, I am a Quince girly through and through now, and having bought many high-quality pieces in my wardrobe at literally like 3 or 4 times the price of my Quince items, I can genuinely say that the Quince items are as good or better than the stuff that I overpaid for. So be like me and get affordable luxury with Quince. Go to quince.com/TFC for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/TFC and get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/TFC. If you're living in 2023 and you're on the internet, your data, very personal data, is probably available to everyone who's ready to pay for it. And it's kind of scary. As someone who has personally been on the internet for over 10 years at this point, like, I was pretty shocked to find out when I did my first Delete Me report, like, just how much of my personal information was available out there. Like, they did their first report and I had my data removed from literally 61 different data broker websites in just the first report. And that's information like my full name, my home address, my phone number, which is honestly terrifying. Because there are companies out there called data brokers whose entire job is to collect huge amounts of your personal info, like your name, address, phone number, social security number, and even information about your relatives, which is all then sold online. Kind of insane. But the good news is that this is where DeleteMe comes in to help you. DeleteMe protects your data from data brokers, reducing the risk of identity theft, scams, and those annoying spam emails and calls that we all get. Their software and team of experts will not just find and remove your personal information from hundreds of data broker websites, but they'll continuously scan for new data that shows up and get that removed as well. Instead of you spending hours of your time figuring out how to remove this data, DeleteMe does it for you. Before you get into a panic, take control of your data by signing up for DeleteMe. It's super easy to use and it simply works. And they offer a special discount for our listeners. Get 20% off your DeleteMe plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/TFC and use promo code TFC. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/TFC and enter promo code TFC at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/TFC, promo code TFC. You mentioned before we started filming that you are looking forward and you want to do more things outside of talking about money, which is something that I think about all the time and have been doing lately, which honestly only reinforces my love for talking about money when you feel like you can do other things. But you come from a different background in the sense of you're a journalist by trade, which I think puts, and rightfully so, right, like a higher standard of kind of seriousness about your approach to things much more. You know, there's always that, you know, real sensitivity about like not speaking outside of expertise, not speaking about issues in a more casual or editorial way. And so in terms of, you know, thinking about what you want to do next with not just your career, but like your life, what are the questions that you're asking yourself to direct yourself to where you want to go when it's such a substantial departure from anything you've done prior or have been trained for?
My goodness. First of all, yes, I want to do a lot more outside of personal finance, and I'm hoping that this book will be a bridge to do that. I think, like, similar to your book, there's potential adaptation. You know, who knows?
Prayers up.
Healthy State of Panic, the one-woman show. I don't know. I think I'm having a lot of fun, and that's a little new for me, and it's like, how can I leverage this enthusiasm and fun? And like, before I wrote this book, I was doing stand-up comedy for a little bit, which is, if you read the epilogue, you'll learn about that.
I cannot believe, is there a YouTube evidence?
Yes. YouTube it.
Oh my gosh. Get thee to, well, you're already on YouTube.
Get thee to the YouTube.
Or you're on Spotify possibly, or wherever you
listen. And actually, it's what inspired the book in some ways. And I've always, you know, you said journalism was my first profession, and that's true, But I had a whole life in theater as well before I started working in journalism. I did theater since I was like a little girl and then all the way through college. But my parents being, you know, my parents, they were like, "You're not, that's not a serious profession. You need to be a serious person." They were on the cast of Succession. "You're not serious people." And so I was like, "I'm going to be serious. I'm going to be a serious journalist." And actually, I wanted to be a war reporter. I wanted to be an international like war correspondent. Picked money instead, which has its own conflicts, but a little safer, I guess. Keeps your boots on the ground. And anyway, I think I would like to do work in more creative spaces like theater, a stage, one of the...
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Things I'm definitely going to do in the new year is more speaking, which is going to, I've written this like 30-minute talk that's a bit, takes on different characters. There's still a lot of storytelling. There's a lot of lessons. Farnoosh,
my goodness.
Coming,
in your improv era.
Coming to a stage near you. And the question that I ask, I guess what I try to keep at the forefront as I'm looking at, you know, what's worth doing next and what can I do next is like, there's a picture that I've been keeping of myself in my office of when I was 4 or 5 years old. Yeah. And I recommend everybody do this because I think there's something really wonderful about remembering who you were as a kid and what this kid really wanted. And when there were no objections, there was no interference, there was a lot of naivete potentially, but just the innocence of that. Sure. I think can't hurt to remember. And I always think like, you know, do it for her. Do it for her. That, you know, little Farnoosh, little Chelsea, and, you know, keeping her with me as I'm now navigating this next stage of my life. I think we are always quick to wanting to become grown-ups. We want to run away from that little girl I always wanted to be like an adult woman. You know, I always hear you talking about how you like, you relish.
I hated being a child.
Yeah.
Hated.
Yeah.
Hated.
And so now here we are, and I think that we've accomplished a lot. We're women with a capital W, and I think giving a nod to that little girl, right, is very, for me, it's been a great motivating tool to get out there and do interesting things and to live up to maybe her hopes and dreams more than maybe 25-year-old Farnoosh's hopes and dreams. What was 8-year-old, 7-year-old Farnoosh wanting to do?
That's real. I mean, I also always feel the need to specify when I say I hated being a child that I had good parents. I had a great whatever. Like I had all the ingredients for. I just hated the feeling of being a child. I had such a feeling of like, why do I have to do what other people say? Mm-hmm. Why can't I? You know, I hated even like wearing kids' clothes. I just wanted to be an adult. That being said, I do think that what you're talking about with honoring sort of what your childhood self would have wanted, that's kind of how I feel when I like surround my media consumption and social media consumption with much, much older women.
Yeah.
Because they're like, all these women I follow, they are in a renaissance. Like they are having like third, fourth husbands in many cases. Like they're living in a way that I think is just really speaks to that idea of like, you get many lives and you get many iterations of yourself. And I do think that for a lot of women, certainly of our mother's generations, but even looking around at women who are my peers, I think that very few of them, not very few, but a lot of them don't give themselves the pleasure and the, you know, indulgence of mm-hmm. just simply asking like, what do I enjoy? What do I want? Who am I? Especially mm-hmm. when they're kind of pushed into an identity of, you know, we don't give a lot of space to mothers in particular, but women as they age generally.
Yeah.
We don't give a lot of space to them to think of them as interesting individuals.
We're caregivers. We're caretakers. My mother now, I know I said earlier that she never had that person who was like, what do you want? And how can I help you? She's now that person for herself in her well, we're young. We're only 19 years apart, so she's in her 60s. And she's living her best life.
Queen. Mm-hmm. Queen. So when you talk about in the book, there is that little passage in the FOMO chapter about, you know, choosing not to have kids and kind of mm-hmm. navigating that choice and things like that. When you look back at the choices that you've made, obviously, you know, some you're incredibly fulfilled by and happy with. But do you think like there are certain choices that you've made that you think I probably made that out of the wrong kind of fear?
Hmm. Wow. It's so crazy because I feel like things have worked out for me, you know, so yeah. It's hard to like go back and go, I shouldn't have done that. Or it's not like I have regret, but I've been a really good parlayer. So maybe yeah. initially I get into something because it's what my dad wanted, or it's because the FOMO that my mother had of, you know, and so I just went with their energy and I arrive and I'm like, a clear example is I studied finance in college. This was after many semesters of not knowing what the hell I wanted to do. I started out in political science because I thought I should become a lawyer because that's what my parents wanted. And I'm good at, I could have been a good lawyer. Like, let's just be honest. Like, I could have figured
there,
it out.
I mean, there's a lot of mediocre lawyers out there. So you could have been a lawyer. We could all be lawyers.
For sure. For sure. And then I said, no, this is not it. And then, I really had to figure it out. Otherwise, at this point, I was probably going to be in college for 6 years because you have to figure things out. You got to get your courses in order and in action. And so my dad was like, why don't you just major in business? And so when I was in the business school, I landed on finance because my dad, again, said, pick a major with an ROI. You're going to college. We're paying for your college. It was Penn State, which they could cash flow out of their paychecks. My parents did not want me to take out student loans, which thank God, but they were like, as a result, we're going to have to go somewhere that's like cheap. So yeah. That was Penn State.
Well, he's not wrong on the ROI things. No, yeah, that was college. Great.
But then I was like, what more of an ROI is there than studying finance? Right. You graduate, you get the highest salary, and you learn how to make money. And so I did that, but my first internship was at CNBC in their sales department. And I realized, like, I don't want to be on this side of the equation. I want to be where the reporters are and the storytellers are. Everywhere around the office, they were airing CNBC and MSNBC. I was in 30 Rock at the time. This was like 1999. And I thought, I really don't want to be an Excel spreadsheet monkey. Like, I really don't. I don't, even though it's more lucrative and more of a straight path. But I kind of want to go on the other side of this wall and be live on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, or, you know, break incredible stories about business and the economy. And so that was the parlay. I was like, I got here. This was kind of a mistake, but how can I make the most of it? How can I leverage this moment in time, this experience, where I am, to like go get closer to what it is that actually is more me? And it was, while I was there, I went to visit different universities like Columbia and NYU, got to know their media programs or journalism programs. I network with some of the reporters. Like, I had access, right? So it's like, take advantage. And then went back to school, did not pivot my major, but started to get some of the other experiences that I knew would help me to qualify for graduate school for journalism. So I did my thesis in media studies. I got internships in journalism subsequent summers, and just made a case for becoming a financial journalist, which I didn't know was going to be my end all, but I was like, that's how I'm going to get into these schools. I need a story. I need to create a narrative around what I'm doing that makes sense, that they can accept me and I can be on my way doing more of what I want to do, which is be a storyteller and be more creative. And also like paying respect to my roots. Like, my parents wanted me to be a finance major. Fine. You know, we're going to weave that in too. But I parlayed that.
It's aspirational. You say you don't have regrets. I feel like I have so many.
I don't know. What's I have a section on regrets in my book. Dan Pink wrote a great book called The Power of Regret. He's like, our culture is so obsessed with no regrets, you know. And
well, that's what I think. It's like, I feel like if you don't feel at least sometimes an acute sense of like, well, that was a flop, I should not have done that, or like, I mean, that was a waste of time.
I think it's very intelligent to say like, I regret that, because there's a lot to learn from our regrets. I don't know. I just feel like I don't have time to like go back in time and be like, I should have done it this way or that way. Like, it is what it is. Things make me sad. I grieve. And maybe that's a sign of regret.
Yeah.
But I call it different things. I call it, you know, that was unfortunate. That was unfortunate.
I feel like I more regret like the way I navigate, like the way I was in situations and the way I navigate things. Because I used to be a much, much worse person. Just much harsher, much more impatient, much more. And I used to have like my sense of, this is like one of the many, many reasons I should never have a child. I would be a terrible mother. I would be very.
Sounds like you'd be all mothers.
No. I would be like certain specific mothers that I've known throughout my life. Not my own. My mom was actually very, very accepting and open-minded in a way I think a lot of mothers are not. But for me, my sense of like my very heightened sense of needing to control outcomes and having specific expectations mm-hmm. would overflow onto other people. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, like, I don't know, what is your relationship to therapy, if you don't mind sharing?
I've never been to a therapist except for my son has a therapist and we see her occasionally as a family.
That is shocking to me. You seem like someone who's had like good therapy in your life.
Thank you.
It's true.
I think that I've done a lot of work on myself in terms of really like, well, it's really like the whole like relationship with fear that I've learned to have. That is for me, the fear was so overwhelming at one point. It was where I wouldn't want to go to work and I would be on like my bathroom floor, like stomach aches, like the anxiety. It was like manifesting very physically in my body.
Sleep issues.
Stomach ache issues, so many issues. I would go to all the gastroenterologists and they're like, what do you do for a living? I'm like, I'm a television producer in New York. They're like, yeah, that's part of the job. I was like, I think there's a better way. There has to be a better way. I don't think I don't need a therapist. I think we can all benefit from professional help. And maybe I will one day turn to that. But I think I've been so independent and so not alone, as I felt very much connected to people around me. But, you know, I've been very solopreneuring my life for so long that there's been a lot of self-reflection. There's been a lot of self-talk and, you know, checking in and just, I think I do though have a really good sense of myself. I don't know if that's something that I just you're born with or not, because you know people who like don't have a good sense of themselves, like they walk into a meeting and they're like, I think that went great, and I'm like, really? That went terribly and it was your fault, you know. But it was, I just feel like people have said this about me where they're like, you know when to joke and you know when to not joke and you know when to like get serious and not, like you can really read a room. And I will say why that may be is because we moved around a lot when I was growing up.
Yeah.
And I was constantly the new girl. Not only that, I was the new girl with the unusual name and a background that was unlike anybody else's. And so I have had to learn quickly on my feet how to connect with people and
kind of swim all circles.
Swim all circles. Know yourself really well. Be good with yourself, because you're going to walk into rooms where people won't want you there and they will reject you. So I've had an early relationship with things like loneliness and rejection. And I think that, you know, I didn't ask for that, but that's how my life panned out. And it's I guess, manifested now as an adult woman where I really know myself.
That's awesome that you were, because I needed considerable therapy and I'm so much the better for it. But it's really good that you were able to come to that kind of on your own and identify what sounds like, I mean, what you describe as being a pretty extreme level of anxiety and kind of walk your way back from it.
Again, I think because as a kid, I had to read the rooms a lot.
Yeah.
And I'm a really good, I think, not always, but I think I can read people pretty well. But the benefit of that is really that you get to see the best qualities in people and what you want to emulate. Like, I've had a lot of role models who've never met me, but I just observe them because I read their work. I see them on TV or I watch them online or I've heard great stories about them. And Yeah, I mean, for a long time, I think growing up, it was always like, who am I going to be when I grow up? You know, we all have that question, like, what's going to be my life? Like, what's going to be my take on things? And how am I going to walk through life? And that for me was always a constant exploration and journey. And to get there, I think I've benefited from just observing and being curious.
Well, on the note of like what I'm going to be, and this is like honestly a genuine question for me as someone who walks this fine line. The difference between I know what I want and I'm going to make it happen and mm-hmm. I'm going to be that person versus accepting to some extent that life is beyond your control and being content with whatever it happens to be. Like, do you have practices that have allowed you to achieve a better balance with that?
Well, I would like for this to be a fear that my children have, which is that the world is imperfect. Things will not work out for you. Just when you think you've done everything right and you've gone to school and you've studied hard and you've shown up early and like, you know, you might still not get the job. You still might not get the promotion. You still might not get the house. You still might not get the money or a call back. And I, again, because I've had a lot of early experiences with rejection, I'm always ready for that. And how I prepare is I do the work that I can do. I control what I can control, but I always have a good plan B or C, or I find for myself, it's like, what's like bare bones contentment? You know, like we were buying a home in New Jersey in the pandemic, or we were hoping we could, and then we made an offer and my husband and I, we were like, this could totally fall through the cracks. We could even buy it and get there and be like, what have we done and want to sell it? So we need to get real solid with another way, a fallback that we would be just as content, you know, experiencing than this home. And maybe that's renting an apartment for a few years until we get our bearings and move into another direction. And I'm like, well, that's fine. Like for us, it was like the most important thing is that we're out of Brooklyn, we're together, the kids are safe. Wherever we end up, we end up. I think that's one of the benefits of growing up with not a lot. My husband also comes from humble beginnings. Like, We know how to survive.
Yeah.
We do. And that's something that, again, as a mom, I'm conscious of wanting, we want to provide for our kids, but you also want to create obstacles for them, you know, in like within boundaries, you know, like you're not going to get everything. You will have a job, you know, you're not going to get a car right away. You're not going to, and I'm going to tell you, like, great job, but that doesn't mean that you're going to necessarily, you know, win the race. Like, you know, that there's always obstacles in life. And my mother also put the fear of God in me as far as like financial stuff. Like when she dropped me off at college, she was like, don't get into any credit card debt. Cause like, we're not your fallback for that. She had a lot of foresight. I was like, what do you mean credit card debt?
We stan a prudent queen.
Yeah.
As a last note, you mentioned, you know, inculcating certain fears in your children. And it's something I'm fascinated by. I recently did a French podcast about money mostly, but we also talked about children, and I had joked on it. This kicked off a bit of a kerfuffle in the in-law group chat. They don't speak English, so they won't hear about this. But because I like jokingly said that like my children would be assholes because I mean, just like an obscene, well, first of all, I'd ship them off to boarding school because I don't want to be a mother, but also, it was a facetious comment, but the intent of it was to say, like, sometimes I think about the life that I live and the person that I am and how much that was informed from coming from a humble background economically, from having these constraints put on me externally, from having a family that had to be very enterprising and very humble in all of their decision making and all of these things. And sometimes I think, you know, when you have, obviously the American dream is to have so much more than you grew up with, mm-hmm. and then to pass that along to your children. But then I always wonder, do people who don't come from much and then have a lot to give their children ever think, like, how do I give them a wonderful life without creating little
monsters?
I mean, like the kids on Succession. And to be fair, again, like as a nanny for some really affluent families, like I'm like, I check in on those kids sometimes and I'm like, ooh, we might have gotten some assholes in the bunch. But it's understandable too, because at a certain level of wealth and access and privilege and without the sort of counterbalancing factors from parents who are very conscientious about that, it's totally understandable that they would end up that way.
Yeah, you have to be extremely proactive and conscious about having those conversations with your kids and modeling that for your kids. I'm nothing against going out in life, doing well, creating a comfortable life for your family and your kids. That's what we all want, right? Like, of course, I want that for everybody. But there has to be with that an understanding of where this all comes from and how life is fragile, and reminding your kids of like what your core values are, which in our family is like service and, you know, being good people, being good citizens. And I don't think kids are getting those conversations regularly, right? They're not getting access to those kinds of deeper discussions. It's and I'll be the first to admit, it's not like a daily thing. You know, it's like my son asked me the other day, he's 9. He said, are we rich or are we poor?
Ooh, interesting. Yeah. What'd you say?
And my advice for anybody who's fronted with that question from a child is to not answer it right away. Ask them a question and say, what makes you curious? Because sometimes that can just nip it in the bud. Like maybe they're just curious because they overheard a conversation at school that, you know, and it's nothing personal. It's just like maybe the kids were using those words at school and they kind of want to like understand it more. Or in our case, we had just come home from hanging out with these new friends of his. The parents had invited us over. It was a camp friend. We were meeting everybody for the first time. I was meeting everybody for the first time. My son and their son were friends. We go over to their house. It's like, it's a mansion. It's just like multi-levels, giant pool. It was like this game room that just like kept going with like multiple toys and all that. My kids didn't want to leave. And when we got home, my son was like, are we rich like that? Like, I don't understand. He was like, why don't we have a house like that? Can we have a house like that? I want a game room like that. And I was like, first of all, we have a very nice house. I said, you know, at the end of the day, I said, Evan, what equals rich? It's a little bit of money. Of course, money matters, but it's also what you choose to do with that money, how you feel. Like, I feel very rich. Your dad and I feel super rich and super lucky that we get to have the life that we have. And the reason we have the life that we have is because we're making choices. You know, everybody has their amount of money, and probably your friends' parents have more money than us, but that's okay. You know, like, that's going to happen. Some people are going to have more, some people are going to have less, some people are going to have the same. But the important thing to remember is that your life is a series of decisions to an extent. And I said, if you want to go out there and one day have a game room in your home, then you should and you can, but not right now. Because we're the ones making the decisions.
That is so interesting.
Yeah. Wait, I mean,
yeah, go ahead.
It's not, I don't think I gave the perfect answer, but I think that had my parents been on the receiving end of that question when I was a kid, it would have just been like, which means shut up in Farsi, you know, or like some sort of like dismiss. And instead, I wanted to engage him because I think ultimately these conversations are healthy. They're going to be imperfect, but we're talking about money, which is more than I think a lot of families do. They don't talk about money.
Oh, yeah.
So at least we're talking about it.
Yeah, I had several of the children I nannied for ask me if they were rich. And I remember I asked my aunt if we were poor when I was a kid, because I think probably a lot of kids ask their parents something similar and they don't get, I think they might say what your parents said to you, which is like, absolutely not. Like, I'm not entertaining this. And so they'll ask other people. But I always wondered, because I never asked my parents directly that question about our money, because I knew like there were money problems and like I knew it was like a sort of negative ambiance over everything, but I didn't dare ask them directly because I felt like that, I don't know, maybe it's rude or would be invasive. Yeah,
it can feel like a really loaded question when you're on the receiving end of it, especially if you have a tendency to think that what you make is what you're worth and that your what you have in your bank account says anything about, you know, your ability to work hard and be smart, which is crock of shit. But, you know, that's what people think. That's what sometimes people think. And like, they don't want to have that conversation because they're worried that like, if, you know, they talk about it, it's going to reveal things about themselves that they don't like.
Well, listen, I'm not going to gaslight everyone. I feel rich. no, I think that's I don't think there's any good, because the thing is, even if you did say to your kid, yeah, we're pretty well off, They're going to go repeat that to their friends.
Right. Well, yeah. Or like, good thing he didn't. He could have also asked, like, how much do you make? That's probably going to come like, that's the next supper. I don't know. But it's, you know, the best thing to do is just kind of keep the dialogue going.
Do you put it out there what you earn?
No.
Okay.
I think, you know.
Some people do. Some people in our space do.
I do that.
Like some people do.
I know. I appreciate when people do, but I have not had great experiences with my income transparency, and not even like on the internet, but with amongst a negotiation even, you know, where I was renegotiating a deal and the woman on the other end of it knew how much I had made previously and basically was like, we're not going to give you more because we think you're making enough. And not like enough because this is what the project is valued at. And it was like, because you should be happy with what you have. And
yikes.
I think it's complex. I think that, listen, I talk about what I make. If you want to talk about that after the show, we'll talk about it. But I'm not putting it on the internet. Like, I just don't. I will happily have, and I do have many conversations with others in my world who are after the same sorts of things like brand partnerships or speaking engagements or book deals, and we talk about it. But I think, unfortunately, the world is not like this kumbaya place where you can put that out there and think that everyone's going to be celebrating it and won't use it against you. It's why employers are not allowed in many states now to ask prospective hires, what is your salary history?
It's important to note, by the way, for when people are,
because they're not using it to be like, well, we're going to give you 50% more. They're like, oh, we're going to give you exactly what you just made, or maybe a dollar more, but that's about it.
Also, in most states, you can't be fired for talking about what you earn with other employees. That's not like a grounds for termination. But just for the record, I don't expect that everyone should do that. Everyone has to have their own relationship to it. But it is, you know, something to consider, especially, you know, if your son could potentially just Google, what does my mom make one day?
I mean, I my net worth is over seven figures, and I was asked to write an article about, you know, I wanted to contribute a piece about my book to a website, and I was pitching ideas, and she was like, what if we call the title of the story How I Became a Millionaire? And I was like, I don't know, but okay, if that's what the bait's going to be, fine. But I mean, technically it's true, but I don't want to, it's like almost Thanksgiving. I don't want to like have, you know, everyone.
Also, I mean, listen, let's be very clear. The country overall has a severe problem with low income, and that is clearly the major issue. That being said, $1 million is what the average person needs to just live a basic retirement. So being a quote unquote millionaire, I think, has a very different connotation to what it actually entails in practice.
Honestly, I feel like I have a ways to go. I still need to save more money for my retirement. And but millionaire carries a certain, there's a lot there that is left for interpretation.
Well, listen, Farnoosh, I deeply appreciate you stopping by. You have an event, your third in New York, your third event tonight in New York. I'm sure you are blowing up inside with anxiety about the evening.
My feet hurt.
thank you for coming. Where can people buy your book?
Well, you can go to ahealthystateofpanic.com and learn all about where it's available. And I have a podcast called So Money, which you've been on many times.
I have.
And it's 3 days a week. And I love Instagram. That's my watering hole.
You got to get over to TikTok.
Huh? Oh, and you're doing so. I just like watching you on TikTok.
You're very sweet. I love making TikToks. I thought I would hate it. And yet here
you're
I am.
So good at
addicted. It. Okay. Well, thank you. And thank you guys for tuning in. And we will see you next week on an all new episode of The Financial Confessions. Goodbye, guys.